Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. On today's show, Sports Illustrated's Brian Strauss gives his thoughts on a busy time in U.S. soccer, including his recollections of his classic 2013 expose revealing player dissatisfaction on the U.S. men's national team with then-coach Jurgen Klinsmann.
The primary trend was that of general confusion, of things not being explained, of things being unpredictable, changing lineups, changing schedules, changing plans for training sessions. They didn't feel like they were being communicated with. They didn't feel like they knew what to expect.
All that and more coming up. This episode of Planet Football with Grant Wall is brought to you by Mack Weldon. Guys, whatever you're wearing right now, Mack Weldon is better. Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Mack Weldon will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants that you will ever wear. And Mack Weldon wants you to be comfortable, so if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it and they will still refund you. No questions asked. They aren't just comfortable, Mack Weldon looks good and it performs well too. It's good for everyday life, going to work, going on dates, and working out. All their products are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using promo code PLANET. Easy shopping, great customer service, good looking, super comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, and hoodies. MackWeldon.com, 20% off using promo code PLANET. All right, on with the show.
Take one.
My three thoughts this week. First, Bob Bradley picked a heck of a way to get his first Premier League win on Saturday. Here's a description of how things went for Bradley Swansea City against Crystal Palace. Down 1-0, to up 3-1, to down 4-3, to up 5-4 with two late goals. Say this about Bob Bradley, his players always keep believing. How many examples have we seen over the years? Landon Donovan's injury time goal to beat Algeria and survive in World Cup 2010? The U.S.'s miraculous 3-0 win against Egypt in the 2009 Confederations Cup to knock out Italy and advance to the semifinals. Even the moment earlier this year when Bradley's Luav team won 5-0 in its final game of last season to come within one goal of promotion in France. Bob Bradley is about belief. Swansea fans are starting to understand.
Take two.
Next up, the Seattle Sounders. For so many years, Seattle was great during the regular season and then underperformed in the MLS playoffs. No longer. The Sounders reached their first MLS Cup final by eliminating Colorado, and the star was local hero Jordan Morris, who overcame illness and scored the goal that sealed Seattle's advancement. At times, the Sounders were horrible this year, but their late-season run under coach Brian Schmetzer has put them in position to make history. It's all very MLS, and it's a great story, too.
Take three.
Finally, what's on my radar this week? Nothing less than the best rivalry in soccer. El Clásico, Barcelona-Real Madrid, this Saturday at 10:15 a.m. Eastern on beIN Sports. Even if you don't like soccer, I always tell people to watch this game. What's at stake this time? Plenty. Real Madrid is on fire with a 31-game unbeaten streak and a 6-point lead on Barca atop La Liga. Meanwhile, Barcelona has been staggering without the injured Andres Iniesta and needs to win this game at home. A Real Madrid victory would open up a 9-point gap with Barca, and the way Zinedine Zidane's team is playing right now, they could certainly do it. The thing about this rivalry, though, is that current form often gets thrown out the window. Barcelona will be hoping that's the case. Our guest this week is one of the premier writers covering soccer in the United States. Brian Strauss started his journalism career at the Washington Post and has worked at AOL, the Sporting News, and since 2013 at Sports Illustrated. He has written a ton of great stuff over the years, nothing more talked about than his 2013 Sporting News expose with U.S. players questioning the methods of Jurgen Klinsmann. We'll talk about that today, but for now, thanks for joining me, Brian.
Everyone else said no, so here we are.
Not at all, my friend, but great to have you on here. We're going to talk about some new stuff. We're going to be talking a bit about your career, which is an accomplished one. But let's get into the news. Last week, Jurgen Klinsmann fired after 5 years as the United States men's national team coach and technical director. Bruce Arena back in through World Cup 2018, his contract will be. What's your sense now that we're a week out from all of this about what's just gone down?
Yeah, I spent most of my Thanksgiving holiday thinking about Klinsmann's legacy and writing about Klinsmann's legacy, which tells you a lot about my life. And the more I thought about it, the more it just kind of really hit home that in all of the ups and downs of the past 5 years, all of the headlines, all the controversy, all of the hope, all of the headlines and stories and memories that we'll have, I don't know that anything was actually accomplished. Mm-hmm. And that's incredible to me. It's incredible to me that with all that time, all that money invested, you know, all of us hanging on his every word for a long time, that I think we're kind of right back to where we started. I mean, the stuff Bruce said in his introductory news conference about, you know, giving this team an identity and building some chemistry and some awareness. I mean, that's foundational stuff. That's stuff that Klinsmann should have been working on in his first year or two. And here we are at square one, starting that again. So obviously it was time for Jurgen to go. You know, it's interesting that Bruce had only 3 years of pro coaching experience when he took over in 1998, and now he's got, you know, 20. And so he's going to be a far different manager now, I think, than he was back then. And he's going to have a lot of work to do, because I don't know that the program has advanced very much over the past 5 years.
I mean, even before Klinsmann got fired, Alexi Lalas asked me what kind of legacy would Jurgen Klinsmann leave if he was gone today. And I was like, well, I don't think it would be an advance over his predecessors. That certainly there were some good moments. World Cup 2014, I still think we're based at this stage in the United States' soccer history about results at the World Cup, not necessarily just about how you play. And even though the U.S. arguably got outplayed in three of those four World Cup games in 2014, they did get out of a very difficult group. They exercised the ghost of Ghana and did better than most people expected they would do. I also see his accomplishments for Klinsmann recruiting dual nationals with much more success than his predecessors. I look at Arena and Giuseppe Rossi, and maybe that's unfair. There's more dual nationals to be had today. But I think Klinsmann did a good job landing some good players. And I do think Klinsmann deserves credit for talent spotting in terms of Jordan Morris, Bobby Wood, maybe guys that not everyone would have spotted or invested time in that clearly are worth it now, and most of us agree on that. But beyond that, I don't know if I see much. Am I wrong here in my thinking?
No, I mean, I do think that the World Cup in 2014, getting out of the group was important because we're trying to build the sport, and you want the attention and the momentum that getting out of the group generated. But when you say that we're all about results at a World Cup, that's true unless the coach comes in promising more than results. This coach came in promising an approach, a style of play, a dynamism, a proactive kind of way of looking at the game that was going to sort of change the way American soccer looked to people. And he didn't do that at the World Cup. And I mean, I remember after the Ghana game, my column being something along the lines of, I think I was may have been writing it on the airplane in a middle seat. It was really miserable. But the column was something along the lines of, you know, the U.S. reverts to what it knows to beat Ghana. You know, mm-hmm. that after 2 years of Klinsmann telling us what the soccer was supposed to look like, we went back to absorbing a ton of pressure and looking to score on the counter or on a set piece to try to win a World Cup game. It was important that he did. I think you're certainly right about Jordan Morris. I think that he turned over more rocks than his predecessors, and that's important. He called in Miguel Ibarra from Minnesota United. Obviously, he called in a Stanford University junior in Jordan Morris. He did look harder, I think, for dual nationals than his predecessors. And so maybe that, and I mentioned this in the column I just wrote over the weekend, you know, maybe that is a bit of a legacy to leave behind, that U.S. national team coaches and, you know, whoever a technical director might be, the federation itself, even the youth national team coaches, maybe there are more places to look than in just sort of the generally accepted pipeline. So that's a bit of a legacy. But he was paid tens of millions of dollars. And he was here for 5 years. And okay, that's a legacy. That's something left behind. But I don't know that it was worth the time and the money. And I think it's just disappointing. I mean, I think when he came in, I mean, when he was hired in the summer of 2011, I was at Sporting News, and they had the Mexico game in Philadelphia already booked. So I covered that. But I was so excited. I loved Klinsmann. I mean, as a fan, I mean, growing up as a striker, I mean, he was phenomenal to watch. And I still remember that sort of little chip and turn he scored, I think, against it was either Bolivia or Korea in the World Cup in 94. It was one of my favorite goals of when I was younger. And I was thrilled with the things he talked about and the potential he thought that there was in this country and the way he was going to kind of tap into guys, you know, habits and motivation and professionalism and nutrition and knowledge of the game and all of these different kinds of things that I thought were really interesting. And I actually paid my own way to Paris in November, my own money, which I didn't have much of at the time, to interview him because I knew if I was in Paris, you know, I'd be like the only guy there. And I'd get a sit down with him. And I sat down with Klinsmann for like 45 minutes in Versailles. And just hung on every word and just thought all of it was really cool and really imaginative. And I was really excited about it. And to sort of go from there to sort of the thud in Costa Rica and to realize that the ball hasn't been moved forward that much is disappointing.
So let's talk about your expose in 2013 for the Sporting News, in which I would argue this is the most talked about U.S. men's national team story of Klinsmann's five-year tenure, because I honestly can't think of anything that's even close, to be honest. So congratulations on doing that. For those who haven't read this story, I think most people in the U.S. soccer community have. This was a story that had lots of players for Klinsmann, unidentified in most cases, as I recall.
Yes, and we can talk about this if you want. I hope all of our listeners aren't clicking off right now. All right, I've had enough. But no, I mean, I learned a lot in the reporting and writing of that story, and some of it helpful, some of it a little demoralizing.
Well, what did you learn? Like, tell the readers what you learned. I'm not going to ask you anything that would, even today, you know, potentially...
People still ask me. Every like, few weeks, some guy on Twitter will say, okay, now will you tell me who said this? No. I don't even know who you are. You know, no, I'm not telling you.
So what did you find from talking to all these players?
First, it was my decision. I was in an interesting sort of situation where sort of the general idea is that if a person knows he's talking to a reporter, that it's on the record unless that person says otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I learned that people kind of have different definitions of on the record or don't use my name or this better not come back to me and all these different kinds of things. And I had some players who I spoke to who never said that. So technically, I could have used their name. And then I had other players who said some variation of that along that continuum. And I realized once I was sort of halfway through, I should have been more thorough when talking to some of these guys in terms of really, really confirming, can I use your name or not? Are you putting your name to this? And when I realized that A, I was unsure about some guys, and B, that I had then a choice if I, you know, I have 100 quotes, 50 of them are from guys who didn't say don't use my name, and 50 of them aren't. Like, once I put a guy's name in the story, those quotes are going to be much more meaningful and resonate much more than a quote from an anonymous player. And in some cases, maybe the quote from the anonymous player had more insight or was more descriptive or was better. Mm-hmm. I also was very cognizant of the fact, once I really got a sense of what was going on inside the team, that I didn't want to be responsible for ruining anyone's national team career. Mm-hmm. I certainly was not going to do that to make my story better or to somehow, you know, boost my own situation. I couldn't live with myself. And I just decided, I put all these things together and I just decided, you know what, I'm just not going to use anyone's name. I'm going to just be blanket for everyone. Even if they didn't say, don't use my name, even if they didn't say this is off the record or whatever, however they wanted to phrase it, I just decided the best and fairest thing to do for everybody would be no one's name is being used. I didn't want to single out the guys who maybe thought after the fact, oh, damn it, I should have said, don't use my name. I didn't want to throw those guys under the bus, you know. And I, like I said, some of the quotes from guys who didn't want their name used were the best. So I just went blanket and I just said, I'm not using anyone's name. I'm going to treat everyone the same. And that's how I did it.
And what were the trends of what all these players were telling you about Klinsmann early in 2013 after the World Cup qualifying loss at Honduras?
The primary trend was that of general confusion, of things not being explained, of things being unpredictable, changing lineups, changing schedules, changing plans for training sessions. They didn't feel like they were being communicated with. They didn't feel like they knew what to expect. You know, he was sort of springing lineup changes on them at the last minute. And this is all about Klinsmann's philosophy, right? I mean, when I spoke to him for the story and I sort of went through, and that was one thing that bothered me, is so many people telling me how biased the story was. And you know, I spoke to Jurgen he was the last interview I did. So I had the opportunity to go through and say, here's what they're saying. What's your response? And now they're saying this. What's your response? And I tried to lay out the story, sort of hear the concerns, and here's what Jurgen says. And Jurgen never denied any of it. I mean, what this story was really an insight and a look into, I think, was the fact that he wanted them to feel a little bit off kilter. He wanted them not to know what was coming. Keep them on their toes, he always said. Swim in the cold water. You know, he wanted these guys to be in a different kind of environment than they were used to, where they weren't sure what to expect, where they had to be ready for anything, where they had to play any system, any position, take anything the game throws at them and be comfortable and have the kind of, you know, dexterity that he thought international players should have. And so what the story, I think, shined a light on at the time was the fact that he really believed this stuff and he hasn't shied away from it. And the players were having trouble with it at the beginning. They were really struggling with the way sort of Klinsmann just approached the sport and training and coaching and developing and building a team. And so, you know, there was no, unless something was corroborated by more than one guy, I didn't use it. I mean, there were some things that were said by individuals that were kind of eye watering, but if I couldn't get anyone else to agree to it, I wouldn't use it. And it built this picture that I was able to go to Jurgen and sort of run through the things, and he responded to them and sort of gave his reasoning for why he did this. One of the things that bothered me was the story came out a few days before the snow game in Costa Rica.
Right.
And it came out like on maybe on a Tuesday and the game was on a Friday. And I got destroyed on Twitter and social media and comments for planning the story to have maximum impact on the national team and to put myself in the maximum spotlight. And that really bothered me, and it still bothers me a bit to this day. I spoke to Jurgen, I think, on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. I spent all day Monday rewriting and writing and putting everything together, and it went out on a Tuesday. The timing of the story hinged entirely on when I spoke to Jurgen. If I had spoken to him a week earlier or a week later, that's when it would have run. But everyone, you know, we've seen it in the election in the past year, right? Everyone thinks the media is involved in these conspiracy theories, and everyone thinks we're in the pocket of this person or that person. And when it came down to it, the story ran on Tuesday because I wrote it on Monday and talked to Jurgen on Sunday. And that's why it ran that day. And so the blowback, the vitriol, and you know, I had people telling me to commit suicide. I had people telling me that I was, you know, purposefully ruining the national team and the World Cup effort. I mean, it was just an enormous amount of abuse. And it was hard to deal with.
I would say also that it got a lot of positive reaction from fellow journalists like me who were just really impressed with the amount of work you had done and the ability to get this honesty from players about their current coach, not knowing if this coach was going to be continuing in the long term as their coach. And also, you know, I remember that week going into the Denver area, and this was all anyone was talking about heading into this huge World Cup qualifier against Costa Rica, which in itself became this classic snow classico, where the U.S. got 3 points. They ended up getting a point in Mexico following that a few days later. And
that was where the legend of Jurgen Dust began. They took one shot. They took one shot, put one shot on goal in 180 minutes and came away with 4 points. Absolutely remarkable.
So in terms of fallout, what was it, not just with fans getting a sense maybe for the first time how dissatisfied the players were with Klinsmann on certain things, what sort of fallout was there for you?
Well, a lot of what I said. just a lot of anger and accusation. You know, I mean, if people who follow me on Twitter might, maybe they haven't noticed or maybe they've noticed, but I don't put myself out there much. I don't talk about myself. You don't know what I had for dinner or what movie I saw over the weekend. It's just not me. And so to get that kind of personal stuff was strange and overwhelming, because I never expected, you know, I was a second tier writer writing for Sporting News. I mean, I had never been in the spotlight before and never expected the story to get that big. I mean, like, German 60 Minutes was hounding me in Denver trying to get me to do an interview. And the players too. I mean, I had an interesting conversation maybe last year with one of the sources for that story, and it came up, and he said something along the lines of, you know, I never imagined when I was talking to you that it would be part of something that got so big. And I said, yeah, me neither. I mean, I never imagined it. And it took, I think, everyone by surprise. And obviously, I'm standing there in Denver in the pre-practice mix zone where Michael Bradley is telling the reporters present that it was, I mean, I don't remember the words. Shameful, maybe, was the word he used.
Not for you, though.
Shameful that players... No, not me, but shameful that players would talk to the media about their concerns. Mm-hmm. And I'm standing 6 inches from him while he's saying this to you know, two dozen writers. And it was very awkward for me because I don't like the spotlight. And I remember having a conversation with you where you sort of said, you suggested that I, you know, say yes to every interview request. And I said no to every interview request. I did not take your advice. And
everyone? I said everyone?
A lot of them. I don't know. A lot of them. It's been 3.5 years. But it's not my personality. And, well, I mean, you had to drag me kicking and screaming onto this podcast. So people were accusing me of so many things. The last thing I wanted to do at the time was make it seem like I was doing this to promote myself,
right,
or for self-aggrandizing reasons. And I felt like if I started doing interviews, that it would seem like I wanted to be the star. And the way I was taught the business is that, you know, we're not supposed to be the news. So I said no to everything. And I just felt that that was the best way to not make it about me and to sort of hide, just to wait till things blew over. And then two things happened. They got the 4 points. And they pulled themselves back into the hex, and then Sporting News merged with Perform and fired everybody. So, you know, there were 15, 20 people or whatever laid off, you know, a couple weeks after that story ran. And then I really disappeared. And I was hired by SI a few months later. And by then, I think people had moved on.
I mean, I'm really glad that your story came out before the layoffs at Sporting News. That's the only positive spin I can put on that. I find it crazy that the most talked about story of the Klinsmann era, the guy who wrote it, was out of a job within days.
I mean, my editor was fired too. He was also the college basketball editor. I mean, we had reporters of from every sport let go. And that was another thing. I mean, you know, we go back to conspiracy theories. The explosion on social media about, you know, Brian Strauss got fired because of the Klinsmann story. U.S. Soccer had Brian Strauss fired from Sporting News. You know, they fired the baseball writer because of my story. They let the NASCAR guy go because of my story. I mean, there was press releases about this. This was a big corporate merger that was covered in the news. And yet people don't. We live in a fact-free society, and people don't do 6 seconds of research. And so I spent some time trying to say, no, I wasn't fired because of the story. I asked Sporting News to make a statement that said something like, you know, none of our writers were dismissed because of, I mean, that was the biggest story that they had in any sport in a while.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't do it. And I was furious about that. And it just got to the point where I just started ignoring it. I couldn't answer everyone. I it still now and then pops up. People still think that's why I was let go. And, you know, if I had done anything, I mean, we had lawyers look at the piece, obviously.
Right.
And if I had done anything sort of untoward, I wouldn't have had job offers. I would have, you know, you would have heard someone from U.S. Soccer say something. And they didn't, because they knew I was careful. I was maybe too careful, like I said, by not using any names. And it was just something I had to weather. And I've tried to stay controversy free since then.
Well,
and it's safe, man.
Sports Illustrated, very lucky to be able to, you know, be in a position to hire you and to have you writing for SI over the last few years.
Thank you, man.
You've been covering a ton of different stories. One of those ongoing stories is MLS expansion, which you really have your finger on the pulse of, I think, from talking to people in a lot of different cities. What to you is the most important part of that process right now, and how do you pursue expansion news?
There seems to be an unending appetite for it, and our editor, Avi Krediter, reminds me of that constantly. When I sort of send him, you know, every couple weeks, I'll make up a list of, hey, you know, here's some things we could work on, here's some ideas I have, here's some things I've heard, you know, let's try to plan it out. And if there's anything on that list that's within the same solar system as expansion, he jumps on it. So as I've said, people seem to care more about the teams that don't exist than the ones that do. It's new and exciting, and, you know, new cities, new logos, new stadiums. People are into it. And obviously, it's about the growth of the sport, you know, and expansion in any league. I mean, when I write stories about NASL or USL sort of goings on, people seem to be into it. So I think it's about covering the growth of the game, and that's exciting for everybody. So I think one of the reasons it's kind of happened this way is because, you know, I'm sort of the, you know, there were a lot of writers who kind of were the first sort of set of, you know, well-known big-time national guys, you know, as soccer sort of became close to the mainstream in this country. Obviously you, and then the person I started my career under, Stephen Goff, and you know, Michael Lewis and you know who they are, Steve Davis, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you're sort of coming in as behind you guys, you know, you have to sort of find your own thing to cover, right? Because especially now that I'm working with you, I mean, you know, you have your sources and you've got your lines out there and the things that you're an expert in and that you cover. And so there's no reason trying to double up. And so I found that expansion was a good way as sort of a writer who came in the second wave, you know, think of me and Doug McIntyre and Kyle McCarthy and, you know, writers like that. You know, where can we find something that isn't necessarily tapped? And that was in a lot of these, you know, clubs that had MLS ambition. You know, you guys weren't covering them. So it was a place where I could start making connections and contacts and some of the lower leagues, some of the lower clubs, you know, people around maybe the MLS office who worked on this kind of thing. And so I think that it started almost out of necessity. Like, how do I find something that I can do that isn't being done by, you know, one of the varsity guys? And that's kind of how it happened.
So I'm going to pin you down a little bit here. Let's have some fun. We have expansion-wise Atlanta and Minnesota coming into MLS in 2017. In 2018, we know that LAFC is coming into the league. Beyond that, beyond 23 teams, what are the five teams you're expecting to get the league to 28, the five cities?
I think Sacramento and St. Louis are probably shoo-ins. So where does that put us? That puts us at 25.
25.
I don't know, man. Is Miami going to happen or not?
I don't know.
Beckham's your guy. See, that's what I mean. I mean, that's one of the contacts. You know, I don't bug Beckham. I'm not calling him all the time because, you know, he's your guy.
Actually, I don't know if I would call him my guy after my book came out, but at least that is my area of expertise. Yes. So,
actually, we both know what it's like to have a famous soccer person mad at us.
Yes.
I will say this about Jurgen, to backtrack just for a second. I never called for his firing, not once, not in that story, right. And not even after the Costa Rica game. I've never had anything personal against Jurgen, and I will say this for him. He was pissed at me for a bit,
right.
But I know that people sort of pulled him aside and said, look, this was legit. The players really said this stuff. You know, Brian got your comments. He didn't do anything wrong. You know, just and he let it go. And I would say over the past like 2.5, 3 years, he's been fine. He's been friendly and kind to me and has answered my questions and has treated me well. If he held a grudge against me, it didn't show. And so I respect him a lot for that. And the stuff he said about the media in general and fans in general, sort of, you know, wondering if we knew what we were talking about and sort of saying, you know, reminding us how much we still needed to learn and grow up and mature. That was collective. But I think individually, he was respectful to everyone. He answered, like I said, answered everyone's questions, said hello to me if he saw me. And so I thought that was cool. And I was uncomfortable for a long time after that came out. And then over time got comfortable in part because of the way he treated me and the way he behaved. So he's a good dude and I respect him for that. And I felt bad that he had to sort of face the firestorm of that story. And like I said, it just was much, much bigger than I ever imagined. Anyway, back to expansion.
We're still at 25 here.
Yeah, Miami. I don't know, man. I mean, I don't know. Michelle Kaufman from Miami Herald seems to have her ear to the ground on that. She's written some good stuff. Neither of us have had much. You know, every time we think there's a movement on a stadium or a new investor, one of us will throw something out there, and nothing happens. So I'm flummoxed by it. I don't know. MLS is really interested in Detroit. They're mm-hmm. interested in what the owners of the Cavaliers and the Pistons are doing there. They've got a site, I think, where there was a prison yard or a site that they wanted to build right. on, and I'm not sure exactly where that is. I think MLS was hoping the stadium referendum in San Diego would pass. I thought I was told by a couple people that would start knocking down some dominoes. Mm-hmm. It failed, however, so I think that puts San Diego in the back. So where does that put us? So let's say Miami, Sacramento, St. Louis, Detroit.
One
How
more.
How many is that?
That's 27.
One more?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Cincinnati?
Cincinnati is interesting. Don Garber is going to be, we're recording this on Monday, the 28th. Don Garber will be in Cincinnati tomorrow, Tuesday, the 29th. Obviously, what they have done has been remarkable. You know, filling Nippert with, 20,000 plus for these games shows what an appetite there is, despite having, I think, what may be the worst brand in American soccer. What does a winged lion have to do? I just baffling. But anyway, but despite that, I mean, that really shows the appetite, right? Despite that, people love it. They've got some real players on that team. Austin Berry, who's from Cincinnati, was, MLS Rookie of the Year with Chicago. John Harkes is coaching the team and is doing well. But it would be the smallest market in the league. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's smaller than Salt Lake. People think Sacramento is a small market. Sacramento is the 20th size ranked media market in the country. It's not a small market. Cincinnati is. And it's not far from Columbus. And if they do go to St. Louis and Detroit, and then with Minnesota coming in, you've got a pretty good Midwestern presence. So I am not convinced on Cincinnati because of the market size and because of sort of where they're filling in the map. The group that owns the team down in Charlotte, some pretty ambitious plans to get a downtown stadium built over this Memorial Stadium site that's not far out of the uptown, I'm sorry, what they call it in Charlotte. Mm. That's a much bigger sort of open space on the map. Charlotte than Cincinnati would be. So, maybe as a wild card, I say Charlotte.
Okay, good stuff. A little bit more on the news before we get into some other stuff. As you said, recording this podcast on Monday, November 28th, Seattle is in the MLS Cup final for the first time in its history. They finally get in the year when you probably thought...
The last year that you'd expect them to do it. It's incredible.
It's so MLS. Jordan Morris, just an epic performance to dig deep through sickness, through all sorts of stuff. Looked out of sorts at the start of this game and scores the winning goal. What's your feeling about Seattle being in this final and can they win it?
Like you said, it's so MLS, right? I mean, all the years they worked really hard to put together those good regular seasons, what a waste of time and energy. Look, you and I agree on the playoff format. Us sitting here and having the same conversation that, lower seeded teams don't need to work as hard. But they finished fourth, and if it was up to me, and only eight teams made it, if they had never increased from eight, Seattle still would have been in the playoffs.
Right.
They were good enough to finish fourth. Obviously, the team that finished the season was not the team that started it. But for not only Morris's performance yesterday, but for the way he has sort of, come into his own and pulled himself up after Dempsey left, that's really remarkable. That, here he is a rookie in his hometown hoping to get some games. And by September, he's not only getting games, but he's the guy. When he signed, Obafemi Martins and Clint Dempsey were the Seattle Sounders forwards. And all of a sudden, here we are in the stretch run, and it's Jordan Morris. And the fact that he rose to that occasion is really remarkable and impressive. And he's a good dude, and I've only talked to him a couple times, but he's just he's earnest and honest, and he deserves this, and he's earned it, and it's cool. And Seattle is I feel a little bad for Siggy Schmidt, obviously, but clearly Brian Schmetzer has the pulse of that locker room, and they play for him. And Ladero, as we know, is brilliant. And I'm a Washington Capitals fan. So anytime I see the Cubs or the Sounders or any of these hard luck teams finally make it, a little bit of my black sports fan heart, you know, kindles just a bit. Maybe it's possible. So yes, of course they can win. It's one game, and they've got some real talent, and they're on a roll.
We're talking a couple days before Wednesday's second leg between Montreal and Toronto. Montreal 3, Toronto 2, heading back to Toronto.
After the stupidest, most insane first leg in MLS.
So what all was so stupid about this? I can think of several things, but for you, what stood out the most?
I mean, you start with the fact that they, you know, thought they were playing indoor lacrosse or something and didn't know how to line the field. That field, you're more of a field guy than me, but that field looked like painted cement on television.
Yes.
And then it was mayhem. I mean, there was literally no structure to that game whatsoever. It was incredible to see Montreal just sleepwalk through the first, you know, whatever it was, half hour of that game.
Toronto, you mean, right?
That's not what I said. I meant Toronto, whatever. All those Canadian cities, I'm sorry. And then Saskatchewan in the second half looked really... tactical adjustments made by Manitoba. I think Montreal's playoff run has been really impressive. I was here in D.C. when they beat United. They're just perfectly built for this kind of soccer. They absorb pressure without looking too uncomfortable. And when I'm watching a game, I always look to see, it's not necessarily stats, it's more this eye test. I mean, who's comfortable and who's not? How hard is this team having to work to accomplish what they're accomplishing? Is it taking every ounce of their energy, or is it something that they're able to do, with relative sort of composure and ease? And that's the thing about Montreal, is that when they absorb, I mean, you think about the difference between, think about the U.S. under pressure against Belgium in the World Cup and what that looked like, and then think about what Montreal looks like when they're absorbing pressure. It's not frantic. It's not random. They're just really well organized and really good at this. And then in Piatti, they have a player who can unlock anything. And so they're perfectly built for this kind of system. And so to see them sort of disintegrate in the second half was really surprising, because they had really kept it together throughout the playoffs so far. So I think that makes Wednesday's game really interesting.
So a few other things I want to talk about here. We got about 10 minutes to go. Back in 1996, the first year of MLS, you were a DC United intern. Is that what it was?
Yeah, they didn't pay me a cent.
So
I was paid in stickers and pilfered temporary tattoos and pocket schedules.
But you have some good memories from that first year, which they won the trophy that year.
Yeah, I got to hold it. It was pretty sweet. Yeah, no, it was an amazing way to spend a summer as a kid. I don't even know where to start. I mean, when you grow up as a soccer fan and pro soccer has played at high schools, and then this league comes along and they're playing at big stadiums. I mean, I just assumed it was going to last a year or two. So I never imagined, obviously, it's still going on. So I just wanted to be a part of it for however long it was going to last. And like I said, try to get my hands on, you know, as many, you know, DC United mugs as I could, you know, just to sort of have as souvenirs. So, you know, I helped Fred Mathis with, he was the ticketing guy. Most recently was the head of ticketing for Sacramento Republic. So the guy who was partially responsible for their incredible crowds. And they brought me in because I knew the clubs in the area. I mean, having spent my whole life, my entire childhood, you know, playing club soccer in Northern Virginia and in the NCSL. So, you know, I knew, hey, we should be at this tournament. You know, this club is big, this club is small. You know, and they'd have me go out to a tournament and pass out schedules. And, you know, sometimes a player would come with me. I think Juan Berthi Suarez.
Chicho.
He came with me one time to like a Virginia, like a high school playoff game or a playoff, like a doubleheader. So we did stuff like that. And then when I had the chance, you know, when I wasn't doing anything, I'd go down to practice. And Bruce Arena was coaching the Olympic team at the time. And so the Olympic guys would come in, maybe it was in the morning or in the afternoon, and the United guys would train in the morning. And now and then, you know, if one of the guys wants to kick around afterward I once spent an afternoon standing in the penalty area trying to finish corner kicks for Marco Echeverri.
Huh.
I mean, remarkable. I would play I play soccer tennis with Michael Bradley, a 9-year-old Michael Bradley, on the sideline. You know, he'd it was summer, so he was doing nothing but hanging around. And, you know, this little 9-year-old squirt with all the cockiness in the world would go at me in soccer tennis. So, nice. Yeah, it was a phenomenal way to spend a summer. And obviously at the time, I never imagined doing this for a living. I never imagined being involved. I never imagined anything but that experience. And it was cool. And yeah, so I went up to the final and they invited me to the post-game party at a hotel in Boston. And I have a picture of me soaking wet, holding the original bowling ball MLS Cup trophy.
What a great trophy that was.
It really was. It had a light underneath.
What?
People don't know. Yeah. It came with a light bulb. The soccer ball, the big bronze soccer ball, was split down the middle. And you screw a light bulb into the bottom, and the ball would glow ethereally. And it was magic. So, it was an awesome experience. When you think about who was on that team, too. I mean, just... you know, I still don't know. Maybe it's golden age kind of syndrome. Maybe it's homerism, but I still don't know if there's going to be an MLS team like that United team in the early 90s. I mean, they had a dozen internationals. You know, we all know who was on that club, and you know, to be. One more thing is another funny thing. I don't get poison ivy.
Okay.
So there was a ring of poison ivy surrounding the practice field at the old Redskins Park where DC United would practice. Mm-hmm. So I would go and get the balls if they rolled into the part where there was poison ivy, you know, and I was down there. I didn't care. For some reason, I just don't get it. So I would walk in and get the balls. So I honestly feel like maybe I prevented like Raul Diaz Arce from getting poison ivy and I helped. So a tiny, tiny, tiny role in their championship season, taking the bullet for the poison ivy.
Fantastic. I don't know what it says when a professional team has poison ivy surrounding its playing surface or practice.
They had the best practice facility in MLS by a million miles.
So, Washington Post, you end up there. How did that get started? What do you remember?
Soccer connections, playing and you know, knew some people who... did some work with, you know, some small soccer publications, and one of them had a job at the Post. And, you know, I interviewed, I was just out of college, and I interviewed to be a news aide. And, you know, basically you answer the phones and, you know, take press releases off the fax machine. We always used to laugh because like half of the press releases were from NASCAR. And we always thought that was funny because, like, you know, you think of NASCAR as like, you know, burning all this fuel, and they're just sort of like, you know, wreaking havoc over the landscape, and we just thought about how many trees they're laying waste to by sending us 100 faxes a day, and you know, getting Tony Kornheiser's mail,
okay,
and typing up box scores from, you know, Division III women's college basketball games and things of that nature, and it was a cool post college job, and the woman who hired me said I would never write a story, you know, this is the Washington Post, and I was fine with that. I had never written a story. I didn't care. It was just my parents wanted me out of the house. So it was cool. And eventually I wrote 800 stories or something because they need people and you're around and they're already paying you. So they're going to send you to stuff. I mean, there was literally no chance of me not writing a story because I was there. And so all of a sudden there's a college basketball game or I think I covered some minor league hockey games or whatever. And they knew I knew soccer, and, you know, Stephen Goff at the time was a copy editor as well. Hmm. So he had to do, you know, 4 or 5 copy editing shifts a night, you know, the 6 p.m., the 2 a.m. copy desk shift. So I, you know, I did all the high schools and all the college soccer, you know, driving back and forth to Charlottesville. And then the WSA started. And all of a sudden, Mia Hamm was playing in our city. And I mean, what do you think? I mean, she was probably the most famous female athlete in the world at the time, right? Oh, certainly in the country.
I would think, if not very close to it at the top.
2001, I mean, she was huge. So all of a sudden, I was covering Mia Hamm every day. And that was, you know, I wasn't even a reporter. I mean, I think I was still technically a news aide, and I had no idea what I was doing. And it was a crash course in how to do the job, you know, because Mia, as people who follow the game know, Mia was... could be a tough nut to crack, and it was there were some good lessons learned. And then obviously I had Stephen Goff, who I think is, you know, on a day-to-day sense in terms of reporting and churning out just impeccable, clean, evocative, well-written copy. I mean, there's nobody better in the country than he is. And so I got to learn from him. And it's kind of a lucky accident. So I, like I said, started typing up box scores and getting mail. And now I work with you at Sports Illustrated. So it's kind of stupid.
Well, I would say this about Goff. I mean, that guy has been doing the daily soccer beat for so long, so well at this point. And just take your pick from any game story. I look back to him, World Cup 2014, the 7-1 game, the semifinal in Belo Horizonte between Brazil and Germany. His game story, you should Google if you haven't read it, because it is insanely good.
What drives me crazy is I've been sitting next to him. I think I finally got an MLS credential he was there from day one. And I finally got an MLS credential, I think, in 2000 or 2001. And I've been sitting next to him in press boxes since then for 15 years. And I suck at game stories. I suck at them because I feel like I feel like the game needs to be over before I have a sense of what's the narrative of this game, what's the story I want to tell about this game. And I can't tell you how often a game is ended and I've got nothing in front of me. And then there's like this, 10-minute, sort of poop my pants hysteria. Like, what am I going to do? And I can't tell you how often there's 10 minutes to go in a game and he's done. He's done with his game story. And how many times is a game decided on a late goal? I mean, there was a stretch where with the national team where I felt like every time the U.S. played, there was a goal in the 88th minute. And it didn't faze him. I mean, he would tweak it in just the right places. He'd rewrite the lead and he'd file a minute after the game ended. And it was just remarkable. And I wish I could bottle 10% of that. He's the best. And obviously that part didn't rub off on me. But in terms of just how to do the job, in terms of professionalism, I mean, there's no way, there's no way I go anywhere in my career, certainly not at a place like SI, without him. And he also mentored Paul Tenorio, who went to the Orlando Sentinel and is now at 442. Paul came after me, and then before me, Will Koontz, who went to Soccer America, was full-time at Soccer America for many years, then became the director of communications for MLS and is now working on the video and content side for the league. So, Goff has put a few guys out there.
Now, we talked a second ago about World Cup 2014 in Brazil. One of my favorite Brian Strauss stories, and I've got to tell it here and then have you chime in, is you were sitting next to me late in that game. Ghana had just scored to make it 1-1, and it looked like another downer for the U.S. against Ghana in a World Cup. It seemed like as if any team was going to score again and win, it was going to be Ghana. And then the U.S. gets a corner kick late in that game. And Graham Zusi goes to take that corner. And what did you say to me sitting next to you before he took that corner?
I'm starving.
Aside from that.
Oh my God, I haven't eaten anything in 10 hours. I think it was just they're going to score here, right?
Yes.
It was three words or whatever. Yeah.
Well, and that's what happened.
Yeah.
John Brooks.
It's crazy. You were screaming. It was awesome. What was it? 86th minute, 87th minute. It was like 4 or 5 minutes after Ghana had scored, right?
I think I had some decorum for a journalist in the press box. I hope.
No, but the whole place was, we're in the stands. No, it was not screaming to a it's not like you were wearing a jersey. Or you remember the there were guys from Ghana wearing those big cat in a hat hats with the Ghana flag.
Those are kind of cool.
Sitting in the press box. It was an awesome moment. And I, of course, I'm also thinking, I'm glad you're doing the game story and I'm doing the column, because two goals in the last 10 minutes would leave me a quivering puddle of tears, and I had to, when I was at Sporting News in 2010, I mean, I'll never, ever, ever forget what it felt like to be there for Landon's goal. And of course we all, we want the U.S. to do well. I mean, yes, we're objective. Yes, we cover the team objectively, but it's better for us. It's better for the sport. It's better. It's just better if the U.S. does well and goes far in the World Cup. Landon scores. It's this incredible moment and this rush of energy. And then immediately there's the whiplash of, holy shit, I have to delete everything I've just written. And I have 5 minutes, or less. To completely rewrite the history of this World Cup and of American soccer in general. So it's very stressful for me. And people always say, I mean, I'm sure people say this to you too, like, oh my God, it must've been fun. That must be so cool. It must be so, it's not fun. I mean, it's cool, But it's not fun. It's incredibly stressful for me. No matter how many years I've done this, sitting at a game and feeling like you've got to find a way to tell the story and that the game and so many things can turn. You know, we talked about Klinsmann's legacy earlier. You know, without that Brooks goal, it's completely different. Whatever it is completely different. And a goal can change so many things. I think that was the ESPN slogan, one goal changes everything. Something like that, right? It does. And so the stress for me to try to stay on top of that and to find the words and to keep my composure, it's harder than playing. I would much rather be in a game and feel like I had some say over it than be in the press box and have to write. It's difficult.
What I've always said is I love my job. I love the experiences. When it comes to writing, I love being done.
It's hard. Just because we do it for a living doesn't mean it's easy. It's writer's block and constipation, and I get stage fright too. I mean, I think one of the hard things about the World Cup for me in Brazil was knowing I was writing for Sports Illustrated, knowing I was with you, knowing I had that platform, as opposed to when I was with AOL. AOL was between the Post and Sporting News when AOL decided for a few years to do content. It just wasn't the same kind of platform. So I had stage fright in the World Cup as well. Was glad that, I mean, you do those three thoughts after the game and you're much better than I am at sort of finding three different themes or three different separate distinct points to make. For me, it all blends together into sort of this mush. And you're really good at that and you're efficient with it. And so I was actually glad during the World Cup that you were willing to do those and sort of leave me with to overthink and overanalyze every little thing, because it gave me a couple hours after the game to sort of work through it all.
Lastly, want to ask you about your scarf collection. Can you explain to listeners what that is?
Listeners, both of you that are still here, you deserve medals. The scarf collection is insane, and to sort of come back to a theme like that story 3.5 years ago, I never imagined it being so big. I remember going on a college visit. You know, they would send you around with other players. You know, you'd spend the day, you know, going around campus with other players, and you know, to see a dorm room was exciting. To see a classroom was exciting. And I remember at one of the schools seeing scarves on their wall that they had gotten. It was a Liverpool scarf, maybe. The team had gone to England or something like that. And it just, you know, back then when your only exposure to soccer was, you know, the results in the back of Soccer America magazine, you know, this is, you know, mid-90s. I used to cut class to watch Champions League on ESPN because I couldn't believe, like, I could on a Wednesday afternoon, you know. So it just seemed magical. Like, a scarf just seemed to represent, like, everything that was authentic and exotic about the world of soccer. So it kind of stuck in my head. And the first time I went abroad, I have a very good friend. His name is Paul Wolfson, who was for a long time the president of the London Owls, which is the London branch of the Sheffield Wednesday Supporters Club. He's a Sheffield native who moved to London as a kid. And so I went to visit him in England, and we went to games, and, you know, a scarf just seemed like the right souvenir. So I started buying them, and it just sort of became this thing where every time I go to a game, you know, I have to get a scarf of that game or of the home team or something like that. And so every scarf represents sort of a log of my soccer travels. And I go through really idiotic lengths sometimes to get them because they're not always available or they're only for VIPs. I mean, I've bribed and threatened fans before. I mean, I've done some really dumb shit to try to make sure there aren't any holes in this collection. And now it numbers well over 200, and it's kind of insane.
Nice. Well, I like the passion. I think that applies to everything you do in the U.S. soccer community. And I'm really glad.
You collect shorts. You collect shorts.
I do collect shorts.
Thing. I like how everyone has a thing.
Thanks. I don't have 200 pairs yet, though, but I
want. You don't have the same level of OCD that I do, but I mean, it's no, they're awesome. I like, it's one thing, again, that's one thing I like. I mean, this sport, no one gets in it for the money. You know, you've got to love it to sort of do whatever you do, whether we all know people who do it as writers, who do it working on the team side, who try to stick it out as players. I gave up, you know, other guys stick with it. You know, guys who try to coach, you know, our former colleague, Liviu Bird, who left SI to go coach youth soccer and PDL soccer. You know, that's how he's going to try to stick with it. And I think that's cool. I think that's something we all have in common, no matter what you do in the sport, is that we're all obsessive and stick with it because we want to see it grow and because it's so much fun.
Well, Brian Strauss, my friend, thanks for coming on. Your voice is great to have in this U.S. soccer community. Can't wait to read more and more.
I will never agree with you. And you owe me so big time for this.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, man.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Brian Strauss, as well as everyone at Digital Media and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Thanks also to our sponsor, Mack Weldon. If you enjoyed this episode, there are other great new and archived episodes you can check out, including my recent interviews with Tab Ramos, Taylor Twellman, Juan Carlos Osorio, Bob Bradley, Gary Lineker, and Thomas Mueller. You can subscribe to, like, and review the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.